It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now to the Madison Mallards, the Summer Developmental League for College Baseball Players. Part of the Northwoods League, 22 teams, including the Rapids Rafters, Eau Claire Express, Kenosha Kingfish in the mix. Nearly 200,000 Mallard fans turned out for games last season at the Duck Pond at Warner Park. And they have a new general manager in Samantha Rubin. Join in on Wisconsin Minor League Baseball, 800-642-1234. That's right, conversation right here, 800-642-1234. Sam Rubin, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
So the Mallards finished the season at the bottom of the Great Lakes West Division. What is,
yes.
And you paused there with a slight laugh, what is your strategy for winning more games next season?
Yeah, you know, last year we really tried something different. We actually outsourced our recruiting. We've done in-house recruiting for years, since really the Mallards have started in 2001. And last year we just wanted to try something new. You know, we thought if it worked, it was going to work really well. And the concept was there. And unfortunately, the execution just wasn't. And so we brought everything back in-house this year. And myself and the team president and couple other people in the organization are really spearheading that search. And, you know, we're kind of going back to what we know works. So I think that's really the biggest thing.
Where do you go to scout? Where do you recruit from?
It's actually really cool. So we create relationships with a lot of the college coaches. We do try to get a pull from Madison and from Wisconsin as a whole. But we'll really just go to college coaches and ask them if they want to send some guys to the Mallards. And we have a great reputation and a great connection with a lot of these coaches. And so really getting people to send their best top one or two guys to us is pretty easy. And it's a great connection making, really, is what it comes down to.
Sam, what's behind that reputation? Why do you get these players? What is the pull to Madison?
I mean, Madison is just such a great city. And, you know, I'm not from the Midwest. I'm from the South, actually. And so I had never been to the Midwest at all before taking the role here. And Madison is just such a great spot to be. You have such a fun community to be around. And we have just such great local support from the Madison community. They back us. Like you mentioned, we've had over 200,000 fans this summer alone come through the doors. And we're really known for our experience. We're known for bringing 6,000 people to the Duck Pond and creating such a fun atmosphere. And, you know, the ballpark itself is half of it is all you can eat and drink. And so creating that atmosphere and playing under the lights with a big crowd like that is really what draws players to come play for us.
Yes, because you are leagues ahead of the other teams in the league in terms of fan attendance. You know, what is the secret sauce, Sam?
I don't know. It really just comes down to giving it back to the community. I think that's really what it comes down to, as well as, you know, really knowing the Madison area, knowing what they're looking for. We partner really closely with a ton of little leagues in the area and do a little league hat promotion. So we actually donate hats to a lot of the little leagues in the Dane County community, so that they don't have to go spend the money on the hats. And so we partner with little leagues, we work with businesses, and it's just understanding what people want. And I think we've kind of figured it out, and having people have a fun time. And there's always places to grow and improve year over year, and just giving people a fan experience and not so much focusing 100% on baseball, focusing on making sure the people in the stands are having a fun time as well.
I think that's interesting because it really flies in the face of how losing teams often go. I mean, it seems like your attendance and the feel and the vibe in this, you know, at the Duck Pond, it doesn't exactly translate when you see a team that is the lowest in with the win rate. So it seems you know, does winning actually even matter to bringing in fans?
Yeah, and I think that's really what it comes down to is, you know, to be honest, this was the worst record in Mallard's history since we started. And so it was a little bit interesting to us as well, is to see how much does that matter and how much do people care. And I think what we figured out is we have the entertainment side figured out. We have people having a good time and the fun in-game promotions and sometimes people forget they're even watching a ball game. And that's really what it comes down to is, yes, baseball on the field matters, of course. That's obviously what we're there for. But making sure that people are having a fun time, even if we aren't super great on the field.
Samantha Rubin with us, new GM of the Madison Mallards. Join in on Wisconsin Collegiate Minor League Baseball. Your vibe, your experience at these games, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show, and we'll continue this conversation ahead here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We have the new general manager of the Madison Mallards with us, fourth GM in the history of the team that continues to top the Northwoods League in attendance records at the Duck Pond. The Northwoods League keeping score here. More than 280 league players have advanced to Major League Baseball. Join in on minor leagues in Wisconsin. Questions, experiences, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Mallard's GM, Sam Rubin, stays with us. Sam, let's talk about the athletes. They are unpaid. The NCAA now allows college athletes to receive payments for using the name, image, or likeness of them. And we saw how last year the Supreme Court ruled the league couldn't bar modest payments to athletes. Should these collegiate athletes be compensated?
Yeah, you know, I think that being in a summer development league is a little bit different than being a professional athlete. So yes, these guys are in college, and some of our athletes that we do sign do have some NIL deals that are done outside of us. But overall, the point of coming to the Northwoods League or any summer collegiate team as a whole is to develop your skills. And so I think that, you know, that is kind of a league decision, is if there is a future of paying some of these athletes. But I think at this point, I personally don't see it happening in the near future. But, you know, I wouldn't be opposed to it. I think it would be a great thing to support these athletes in their endeavor to become a professional.
Yes, and this is controversial. For a long time, compensation for minor league players. And now we see that more than half of minor league baseball players have voted to unionize recently.
Yep.
And Major League Baseball this month officially recognized their union. What impact will that have on your sport and how it's run?
Yeah, you know, so because our guys are not professional, there is not, you know, there's not a union for them or anything like that. I think that minor league baseball players absolutely should be unionized. I think that what they're doing is kind of the future of the sport. And the way that Major League Baseball is set up with their minor league system is completely different than really any other sport. You don't really see a league system like that. And so I think that there's a lot of trial and error of what's happening. And I think that them kind of coming together and banding together is something that's great. But our guys are still in college. They're still, you know, 18 to 21, 22 years old. So you have a younger collegiate kid who, again, might have some NIL deals on the side or done through their schools or anything like that. But, you know, they're not professionals. They have not been drafted by the MLB. So we're completely separate from that. So it is an interesting take. Absolutely. And it's something that we're absolutely open to. It's just a matter of kind of what that future holds. It's really an ever-changing field to be in right now, with all the NIL deals coming through and really what's allowed and what's not, and working with compliance directors at universities. So it's a very changing place to be right now. So it's an interesting topic, and we've talked about it internally, but you know, we're still trying to navigate it ourselves.
And certainly, you know, from someone who sits in the stands, it's something that I think about as I look out on the field of talented players and watch their craft. It's something that certainly goes through my mind. I want to ask about you being the first woman general manager for your organization. What does being that mean to you?
Yeah, you know, I mean, Madison is such a great place to be, and being the first female GM in Madison specifically, or really anywhere, is just such an exciting time. Being able to kind of be that that person that maybe a younger college female might look up and say, you know, I can't work in sports. And really seeing people in a role like this or all over the country. You know, we have the Marlins, who hired the very first female GM in all of the big four professional sports. So you have this big conversation and this big movement with not only front office staff, but professional athletes, women professional athletes as well. And it's really a big time to be a part of it. And so being someone that people can kind of look to and look up to and say, you know what, if I can do that too. And that's what I did when I was in college. I reached out to all the professionals, specifically women, that I could in the sports industry. And it worked. I mean, I connected, I networked, I did whatever I needed to do to make it kind of get to where I want to be in a role that I'm happy with. And being able to kind of be on the other side of that is something that is something I've always dreamed of. And it's something that is just so exciting to be able to kind of be that person for someone else.
Sam, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Samantha Rubin, general manager for the Madison Mallards collegiate minor league baseball team in the summer months. Up ahead, a UW-Madison scientist discusses how climate change is affecting extreme weather events. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Heavy rainfall in southeastern Wisconsin earlier this month, it prompted the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewerage District to initiate what's called a combined sewer flow. We discuss the consequences of that overflow pipe carrying excess stormwater and wastewater into waterways and ultimately Lake Michigan. Join in 800-642-1234. Conversation is here, 800-642-1234. Steve Vavras is co-director of the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impacts, also known as WICI. He's a senior scientist at the Nelson Institute Center for Climatic Research. Steve, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate. It's great to be here.
So when you saw storms dumping almost 5 inches of rain over Milwaukee in 24 hours, leading to 756 million gallons of wastewater being discharged into Lake Michigan, what went through your mind?
Well, like everyone, the concern first and foremost about health and infrastructure. There was a flooding, closed parts of I-94 around Waukesha, for example, and undoubtedly flooded basements. The biggest concern about one of these combined sewer overflows is the health impact. As untreated wastewater goes into Lake Michigan during the summer, that can lead to beach closures as we get bacteria that flows into Lake Michigan. And so this is always a concern from a public health perspective.
Is it becoming more common due to climate change?
Absolutely. These heavy rainfall events have become more common around Wisconsin, around the U.S., around the world. And we certainly expect that trend to continue, mainly because warmer air can hold more water vapor. And so when we get the right weather conditions, like we had a couple weekends ago, more rainfall can be wrung out of the atmosphere.
You know, the group, the Alliance for the Great Lakes, says tens of billions of gallons of raw sewage and storm water end up in the Great Lakes each year. Why is this happening? Is it about infrastructure, or is this because of our warming climate?
Well, it's a combination. There actually has been a big infrastructure change in Milwaukee, for instance, the creation of this deep tunnel that stores stormwater when amounts get to be huge, like we had a couple weekends ago. But eventually, if the rainfall is too much, and this happened to be Milwaukee's sixth wettest day on record, even the deep tunnel can't hold everything. That reservoir has a finite capacity. And in that case, the release valve has to be that that water flows into Lake Michigan. So the infrastructure has improved. The number of combined sewer overflows in Milwaukee has dropped drastically down to just a couple per year. But even so, that can still cause problems.
Conditions in Lake Michigan have historically been not so nice for the survival of bacteria because of the lake's temperature. How could climate change affect the lake's vulnerability to bacterial contamination?
Well, warmer waters are more favorable for bacteria to survive in, and that's true not only in Lake Michigan, but our inland lakes in Wisconsin too. So we're talking this morning mostly about a water quantity problem, but also water quality is a big deal too. And we expect that in a warmer climate, not only would water quality be compromised as we get more runoff of pollutants into our lakes, for example, but also the warmer waters are more supportive of the contamination, the pollutants in those, and that can exacerbate the water quality problem too.
So these storms lingering in place longer than typical, this cutoff low, and you've said this type of storm can really cause a double whammy. Could climate change make rainstorms like what we saw in Milwaukee last longer than normal?
Well, the jury is still out on this. This is a fascinating question from a climate perspective. As you mentioned, this is this cutoff low. That means that it's a low pressure cell that was cut off from the main jet stream circulation. The jet stream acts kind of like a highway on which weather systems move. And one of these cutoff lows gets separated. It's like taking an exit off the highway and then parks itself for a few days and just keeps dumping rainfall in the same location. In this case, it was mostly southeast Wisconsin. And there is evidence that the jet stream winds will slow in a warming climate, particularly in summer, all the way into September. And whether these cutoff lows in particular become more common is a very open question. I think we need to do a lot more research on that topic.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about this recent historic rainfall in Milwaukee and how common it may be in the future. Steve Vavris here, a senior scientist at the Nelson Institute Center for Climatic Research. I wonder, Steve, you know, so many cities around the Great Lakes have these coupled sewer systems where the storm water and the wastewater go into one place, if I understand. How costly and hard is it to decouple sewer lines and pipes that carry storm water?
Well, I'm not an expert on that. I'm not an engineer. I suspect it's quite expensive, and especially for bigger cities like Milwaukee. However, that isn't the norm. In most places, the storm system, the storm sewers are separated from the sanitary sewers. If that's been done historically, you're in good shape. Milwaukee is one of those places where it was combined from the beginning. And so now there's bigger problems. In the past, when we had fewer of these heavy rainstorms, there weren't many instances when this became a problem, but now obviously it's becoming exposed as a bigger climatic change problem.
Well, let's look at some adaptation here. What could you do to slow this kind of water heading into our fresh waterways like Lake Michigan? What are some options that we could do to the landscape?
Great question. Anything that we can do to increase the infiltration of stormwater into the soil is a good thing, and it'll reduce the problem that we saw with the flooding recently. So these include things like trying to create more green space, for example, more rain gardens, for example, rain barrels. Wetland protection is a big one. Wetlands are natural sponges that absorb a large amount of stormwater. And helps to slow the flow. But urban areas like Milwaukee have a big problem that we have so much impervious pavement. So things like roads and parking lots and driveways and sidewalks, none of that allows rainwater to infiltrate. And therefore it runs off and can create large problems when those hit streams or Lake Michigan in this case. But anything that we can do to increase that infiltration rate is beneficial.
What about ditches? And I know you mentioned rain gardens. Is that to basically slow that water from getting to these water bodies?
Right. So it can slow the rate at which the water moves over the surface. So that's one benefit. And then if there's green space, for instance, with a rain garden, it actually does soak into the soil. And then another benefit of something like a rain garden is you have vegetation in the garden. And that also helps to soak up the excess rainwater. So there are multiple benefits to what we call green infrastructure things like rain gardens, for example, and wetland protection. And so there are a lot of these natural solutions that don't require big engineering projects like the deep tunnel, although that was an adaptive mechanism too. But these are things that often have co-benefits because they provide more green space, help to draw down carbon from the atmosphere and so forth.
So if you're a city, a local authority, and you're trying to figure out your budget and think, well, should we try to upgrade with a deep tunnel and upgrade our sewer system, or do we look at this green infrastructure you're talking about? How do you, you know, what is the correct balance in order to most protect the environment and the water?
Right. There's a whole spectrum of options that we need to consider. And really, each community is unique. Milwaukee has its own challenges being this massive urban center. But there are smaller communities, rural communities that would have different issues. They don't have nearly as much impervious pavement that a bigger city has. And so you really need to look at the whole spectrum of options for adaptation in your playbook and decide which ones can you afford, which ones will give you the biggest bang for the buck. But one of the benefits of green infrastructure is that a lot of those options are low-hanging fruit. They're things that are not expensive, relatively speaking, and there are things that can be done very quickly. So, you know, rain barrels and rain gardens and swales, these are things that individual homeowners can do, and communities can help by promoting that, incentivizing those, and helpfully make those more prevalent in their community.
But if the pavement goes down, getting that pavement up and transforming that space into green infrastructure, that is a sizable challenge. To me, I think when pavement goes in, that's it. It's there.
You know, there is something that's been developed called called permeable pavement, which is what it sounds like. It allows rainwater to infiltrate through the pavement itself. And it turns out that it's not really more expensive than traditional surfaces, asphalt surfaces, for example. And so some communities have adopted these, this kind of pavement, and there is potential. There are some limitations though. For instance, it can't handle as heavy a load of vehicles. So for instance, emergency vehicles may be too heavy to ride on permeable pavement. And so there too, a community has to decide where it would be most strategically placed and where it just isn't well suited.
We have less than a minute left, but as you look at these large cities that dot the Great Lakes, are they working together enough to find these solutions? Because they all struggle with the excess water flow of stormwater and wastewater, it seems.
That's true. It's a very common problem along the lakeshore. And one of the goals of the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impacts, WICI, that I'm co-directing, is to try to help communities work together and find common solutions. A lot of the problems all along the Lake Michigan shoreline have similar causes and similar solutions. Each one needs to be tailored somewhat to each community's needs and budgets. But as you say, that they really do have a lot in common. And in this case, the impacts of waterborne disease potential as floodwaters go into Lake Michigan is also common throughout all of those cities.
Steve, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kate.
Steve Vavras, co-director of the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impacts and a senior scientist at the Nelson Institute Center for Climatic Research. Just ahead, we look at the crisis of confidence in the American government through the lens of your tap water, your drinking water, with the author of The Prophets of Distrust. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.